thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 33 for the 31st of October, 2008. Classroom Action Settlement. I'm Dan Cohen. And welcome back to Digital Campus after an unplanned month off due to all three of us being just far too busy with things like writing grants and taking care of all the things we do during our day job. We haven't moved over to 100% podcasting yet. But we are glad to be back, and thanks for all of your notes of concern that we somehow went away. But we are here with the regulars, Tom Scheinfeld. Hey, Tom.
Hi, Dan.
And Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hi, Dan.
And Tom, you're actually podcasting today from Linux for the first time.
Indeed.
We've been such Mac fanboys here on the podcast, but you've converted over in the last week. How's that going?
It's going well so far. I have converted over. I'm now running everything on Linux. I'm running it on my MacBook Pro. I'm keeping a small partition with a dual boot into Mac OS X in case I need to do something I can't do on Linux yet. There is somewhat of a learning curve, but actually not as much as you'd expect. So it's going very well. And I just finally got completely fed up with, well, I think that certain things that commercial software companies have been doing lately have just gotten to me, and it put me over the edge. But it's also my lust for the new MacBook Pro just seemed completely unreasonable. I found myself like really, really wanting one and thinking, I have a perfectly good computer here. I don't really need this. I have to get off this Apple train. So I finally did it, and hopefully I can stick with it.
So, I mean, Linux has really taken over in terms of web servers and you know, more advanced applications. And I suspect most people in our audience who maybe are running Linux are probably among the geekier parts of our audience. For just the straight-up-the-middle mainstream user in academia, is this something now with the latest version of Ubuntu that someone who's maybe less technically sophisticated could kind of get a grasp of, move over to with few problems?
To be honest, I think they could. In some respects, it's the kind of middle user that's going to have the most problem with it. I think the very basic user, the person who really just needs to use a web browser and use an IM client and maybe occasionally open up a document or a PDF or something, that person's going to not notice any difference. I mean, it works and looks very much like the other graphical user interfaces, you know, Windows and Mac OS. I think the person, you know, the really geeky person who likes to do everything at the command line is going to, you know, just love it. That kind of middle user where, you know, you can do a lot of stuff, but you're not really comfortable at the command line, that person is going to have a steeper learning curve. At the same time, I'll say that, you know, because Mac OS is based on a Unix platform, for somebody who's been working on Mac OS for a long time and has gotten into the guts and used the command line there a little bit, it's really set up very similarly. I mean, a lot of the commands are the same. A lot of everything is the same. So I it's gotten a lot better. Desktop Linux is really coming into its own. And I think the advent of all these netbooks, these small, lightweight, low cost laptops, things like the EPC that are running flavors of Linux, are going to get people really comfortable with it. And I think we'll see steeply growing market share over the next couple of years for desktop Linux flavors.
Seems like a perfect kind of computing environment for, let's say, the student who could buy an Asus EPC for $400 with Ubuntu on it. They're doing most of their stuff in the browser anyway. You know, they probably have Gmail, so that runs perfectly fine. So it's a pretty inexpensive solution, and actually also not bad looking, and lightweight and inexpensive. So seems like a pretty good solution.
And, yeah, it's on its way.
And I'll say that when I was in Cambodia 2 years ago, all the Cambodians who I encountered who weren't just using an internet cafe but actually had a computer themselves, they were all using Ubuntu already just because everything else is just too expensive there.
Right, right. Well, speaking of other shiny new things and things to try out, it was almost a year ago that the three of us declared 2008 to be the year of mobile technology and its importance for what's going on campuses and its uses in museums and libraries like podcasting and location-based applications for historic sites. Another sort of major piece of that seems to have fallen into place in the last week with the release of the Android-based phones from T-Mobile in the United States. And so, again, Android is the platform, and now, indeed, over the last week, the fully open-sourced platform that Google has created for mobile technologies. Well, I was lucky enough to get a hold of one of these things and take a look at it. I still am using my trusty iPhone, and I know that, Tom, you've mentioned you might be in the market for one of these Android phones. And first impressions, not bad. It's a nice-looking interface. The phone was a little less clunky than I thought, but I think what's really struck me, at least, taking a look at one, is I think its potential for all the reasons we said a year ago, that particularly since it's open source, I think for people on campuses and at museums and libraries who want to build applications, you know, you don't have to put an application through the Apple Store, the iTunes Store to get it onto the phone. You can actually even load an application straight from a web page. I suppose one issue might be that there's no equivalent of an Android-based iPod Touch, which we discussed was a sort of important component of using mobile on campus, where, for instance, you could have 20 iPod Touches as you know, for classroom use without a contract from AT&T Wireless. But still, is this something that is really another turning point in this trend toward mobile?
Well, I at least for classroom use, I just can't wait. I mean, it's I'm teaching a class this summer that's really going to be in some ways a place-based computing class. And if, you know, if I could convince T-Mobile or Google to give me 15 or 16 of these phones, it would be a much better experience because my students are going to be fanned out over an area about 100 miles by 20 miles doing research in local archives and historic sites and things like that. And if they could be photographing and uploading quickly to a database and then, you know, attaching other kinds of metadata to whatever it is that they're uploading, it would really make the project that much richer. And I think the fact that this is going to be open source means that we're going to see a lot of educators beginning to design or finding computer science students who can design quickly for them, you know, the simple application that they need for the class that they want to teach next semester. And, you know, with the Apple AT&T situation, that's just impossible.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the, you know, an important point to make here, I think, in light of our last discussion, is that, you know, Android is itself a flavor of Linux. And so we're sort of seeing this kind of convergence where the lightweight open source Linux flavor is entering the cell phone market. Sort of coming, it's kind of up featuring the cell phone, and it's coming into the laptop, kind of down featuring the laptop, and we're seeing some convergence there. So I think it's only a matter of time, really, before we see some kind of iPod Touch like Android device, even possibly a netbook running Android. I think that this is this area where there's these devices are converging. I think the iPhone was the first of them to really change the way we look at the phone and to say the phone is not a phone, the phone is a computer. And I think we're going to see more of that. And I think the Linux kernel is really going to facilitate that kind of convergence. So I think, you know, if this was the year of the phone, I think next year we could see sort of the year of the convergence device, the rebirth of the kind of Apple Newton from years ago, where it's kind of a PDA, it's kind
Break
of a phone,
Newtons
it's kind,
yeah.
kind of a laptop, it's kind of all of those things. I think that's what we're going to see a lot of in the coming year or two.
Right. I mean, you know, this is an operating system that really has some of these services that are required for some of the kind of applications we want baked in. I mean, location-based services in particular, Google has really put a lot of effort into. And so Android, right out of the box, right on this first-generation T-Mobile phone, for instance, has Street View and has all kinds of access to the kinds of things we'd want. For instance, you could, I mean, right now with this device, you could send students out and have them, for instance, access items that have been placed into Google's various mapping technologies. So, you know, historical photographs or things like that. This could be done right now. I mean, you know, at the same time, not to leave the iPhone aside, but Google also released Google Earth for the iPhone this week. And that also includes that functionality where, for instance, you could view, for instance, Rome, modern Rome, through Google Earth right on your iPhone, but also look at photographs of the buildings or what they used to look like in ancient times right in Google Earth as people sort of increasingly put those layers on top of Google Earth. So I think there's a lot of you know, a lot of potential there. And I know while, you know, perhaps for the foreseeable future, the kind of more high-end geospatial projects in academia will involve GIS, Google Earth and Google Maps really provides a kind of quick and dirty way of doing this. And boy, it sure looks good.
Well, and the other thing I'd say is that I think something that's going to fuel the development of these kinds of devices as mobile computers will be that they're really promising commercial applications too. And so, for instance, if you were the person in charge of all the bridges in the state of Virginia, to be able to send your engineers out to do bridge inspections and photograph all of the rusting rivets and things like that and have all of that uploaded directly into a database where somebody then trying to figure out how to allocate engineering resources can actually look at what's going on. That sort of commercial application, I think, will really drive a lot of the innovation that we'll then be able to benefit from.
Yeah. I also think the lack of restrictions is going to help out a lot. I think of the use case of the museum that, for instance, might want to use some functionality that Apple is currently not allowing in iPhone apps, for instance, podcasting functionality. On the iPhone, you'd probably have to download a podcast ahead of time. You could create, for instance, a specific, let's say the Metropolitan Museum of Art could create an application that basically acted like a podcasting application. Let's say, as you go through the galleries, it could download different podcasts based on where you are. And it seems like, with Android, there are no restrictions. You can just go ahead and do that. Apple might reject your application, again, based on an overlap with some core functionality of the iPhone. So I think there's the flexibility factor also will help.
I think the fact that, too, that the other thing we've seen in the last week is, for instance, Motorola has made a commitment and has started a new team of developers to start working on Android. They are pretty much going to dump for almost all of their phones, their own proprietary operating systems. They've had a series of duds in the marketplace ever since the release of the Razr, like 3 or 4 years ago. Their phones have not been selling well. And so they're committing to Android going forward. And if we see a big commitment by a lot of different hardware manufacturers and cell phone manufacturers, we're going to see a lot of innovation in this space. And it's going to run on a lot of different kinds of phones, which are going to reach a lot of different kinds of people. People who maybe just don't, want a different kind of phone than the one than either, the one that T-Mobile's looking for, selling now, or the one or the one Apple is selling. There's this huge variety of hardware out there, and Android is going to be able to run on all of it. So that's an exciting thing as well.
Yeah, and there was actually just a study out today from, I think it was Moco News, that said that actually the fastest growing segment of smartphone buyers, including of the iPhone, which is a pretty high end device at this point, is actually in lower income groups. In fact, the strongest growth is in the segment from users who make between $25,000 and $50,000. And the speculation is that the growth in this, we tend to think of the digital divide, but here's a case where these mobile phones are really becoming all-purpose devices. They are computers. And so what they're saying is that in this report that just came out from, I think it's from ComScore, the internet measuring company, and they're saying that, basically some of these devices can sort of replace the more expensive laptop or desktop machine. Since it really can do everything. It can, browse the web. It can get email, do a lot of things. And so they're showing growth, smartphone growth throughout all these segments. Well, we're talking about big commitments, like Motorola's hiring 350 people for its Android development team. Another big commitment is coming out of Microsoft and their kind of next generation operating system. Indeed, they've gotten the gospel again. That's something else that we've been talking about for the past year here on the podcast, of the importance of the cloud and cloud computing, or the fact that applications, including many of those used in academia, are kind of moving off the desktop, moving from desktop applications to things like Google Docs and Zoho Office and these sorts of things. And they've made a big play over the last week with Azure. Have either of you followed this, Tom? Do you want to explain a little bit about what the strategy is here and what it might mean for the next few years?
I can do my best. It's still a little unclear what Azure is going to be exactly. It was just announced this week, and I don't think anyone has really had a chance to do anything with it. It was a kind of a keynote presentation of it. But essentially, what it is a kind of online web services platform for that Microsoft is releasing. It's going to be a combination, I think, of an online operating system, but also a development platform of the kind that like Amazon is has with EC2 and S3 storage. And so people will be able to develop apps that run on this platform hosted by Microsoft. They won't have to have any, you know, hardware. There'll be no like big iron sitting in a closet somewhere. They won't have to maintain their own servers. They will just be able to develop for this platform and mount online web applications through this platform. Microsoft is also going to be delivering its own applications through this platform, which will amount to essentially, I think, an online operating system. I'm not quite sure how this relates. What I don't quite understand or know yet, and maybe listeners can try to explain it in the comments to the show. How this relates to the development of their desktop operating system, their Microsoft Windows, and how the two are going to interact, or whether Azure is intended to be a replacement for Windows. I doubt it. And where that's going. I mean, Microsoft tends to, it seems like, throw a whole bunch of different stuff out there and see what sticks. And so I'm sure they're not abandoning plans for the next plus one version of Windows. But it does seem like they're making a big commitment to developing this online operating system. And one of the signals of that is they're in the next version of Office. They've announced that they're going to have an online version of the Office application suite to compete directly with Google Docs and Google Spreadsheets and Google Presentations and other things. So they definitely are catching on to this this strategy and this development. I'm just not quite sure where they're trying to position themselves and where they're trying to go with it.
Right. Well, I mean, it does seem like they're going for a hybrid view here. It's not going to be totally in the cloud that is online in the same way that all of Google's applications are. It sounds like you're still going to need the desktop application itself to get full functionality, but you will be able to access, and indeed they showed an interface that looks remarkably like something like Google Docs or Zoho's Writer, which is another one of these kind of web applications that simulates a desktop application for word processing. So you can kind of access it in both places, and I assume they'll have to do tackle the very thorny problem of how you synchronize data across multiple desktops and things like that. But I guess they must see that they need to at least plant one foot, if not both feet, and this does seem like they are straddling the two worlds. But at least one foot has to be in the cloud in this modern age. I think they are seeing that, even though it's perhaps 1% of the audience is using, let's say, Google Docs compared to everyone who's still paying for Microsoft Office, but they know that the growth is going to be on that side of things, the cloud side of things. So they've got to start at least moving in that direction.
You know, and it's interesting. I mean, if you look at the new version of Microsoft Office 2007 for Windows, if you look at that interface, a lot of people were surprised by how radically Microsoft changed the interface for, say, Microsoft Word, where they replaced the kind of pull down menus with this ribbon model, where it has kind of a tabbed interface to the software, to the menus and stuff. And a lot of people were surprised that Microsoft did that so radically. But now it seems like with this move to the cloud, you know, you sort of realize that what they were really doing was they were positioning and Microsoft Office to go online. They were getting users of Microsoft Office ready for that switch, because the ribbon, this new ribbon interface, looks a lot more like a kind of tabbed web design interface. And so they're, I think they've made a kind of long-term commitment where they're trying to get desktop users of their products accustomed to what a kind of web app looks like before actually moving them to the web. And then when they launch the web versions of these tools, users are going to kind of intuitively understand how to use them. So I think that was actually, for Microsoft, who sometimes bungles these things, was actually a pretty slick move. So they definitely are making that commitment.
Yeah, great point to sort of get people used to a new UI and some of that functionality. Well, I suppose we'll have to see if, Tom, as you said, you know, they throw a lot of things out there and some of them never actually come to fruition. So we'll see if Azure is truly something or merely vaporware like a cloud. Well, all three of us really saw the biggest story of the past month and certainly of the past few days as being the what very well could be a landmark agreement between Google and authors and publishers who had sued the company under a class action suit for what started out as the Google Library or Google Print Project and is now known by the name of Google Book Search, of course, available at books.google.com. For those in the audience who aren't aware of this project, it's their project to scan really whole libraries into Google's index and make copies of them. And they've worked with dozens of libraries at this point. They start out with the Google Five, and I'm probably going to forget one or two of them, but I believe it was New York Public Library, Harvard, University of Michigan, Berkeley, and Stanford. Am I right about that? I'm probably getting that wrong. But they start off with five, and they've added a bunch in the U.S. and then overseas as well now, in Europe and a couple of other places. And they've been scanning in books. We now know, indeed, from this agreement that they've scanned in 7 million books, which is really just a remarkable number. Just to, for comparison's sake, the Open Content Alliance has scanned in, it's a little unclear, they say it's somewhere around 1 million. When I look at archive.org's text page, which is where they store a lot of these things, I believe it's coming up somewhere in the 400,000. So this is a lot of books that they've scanned in. And of course, Google took the view that they could really scan anything in the library, whether it was in copyright or out of copyright, whereas Microsoft, which had been also doing a mass scanning project up until the summer, took a more limited view and was only scanning in public domain books, which are generally books produced before 1923. So Google just went ahead and just took whole shelves off these off of these libraries and scanned them in without regard for when the book was published and whether it was in copyright or out of copyright. And of course, that's what really precipitated the lawsuit. Google initially claimed that this was a sort of fair use, that they weren't going to show the whole books that were in copyright on in full view, that they would only show what they called snippets or little pieces of the book online, but they would allow you to search it. And they viewed that capacity to search through the entire library, the full text of these books, whether they were in copyright or out, as a kind of form of fair use. A bunch of authors and publishers sued. I believe the two main plaintiffs were the Authors Guild, which represents a lot of authors, of course, and the American Association of Publishers, the Association of American Publishers, AAP. You know, really, for the past 3 years, they've been struggling to see if this would go into court or be settled. And just this week, after weeks, really, of rumors that there was a settlement of the works, we now have the outlines of that settlement. And, of course, we will link to the full settlement, over 100 pages, from digitalcampus.tv for this episode. And we'll also link to some other, I think, more clear and less legalistic interpretations of exactly what this settlement means. Now, just a couple of words before we begin our conversation about the larger meaning of this. This is still a little bit up in the air. The settlement has to be approved by the courts, and that hasn't happened yet. And we should also mention, given that we do have an international audience for this podcast, that as of our talking today, it looks like that this class action lawsuit would only settle the United States portion of this. So it's a little unclear what will happen in terms of usage of Google Book Search outside the United States and what is covered in that way. So still a lot of things up in the air and a lot of details, I think, still to be sort of mapped out for the academic audience and the audience in museums and libraries who I think probably care a great deal about this. But the basic outlines are that, because of this agreement, they will now actually be able to provide full views of books that authors and publishers allow, and then they have a revenue sharing model with those authors and publishers, and it is indeed skewed toward the producers of the books. 63-37, I believe, is the figure I've seen for the cuts that the authors and publishers will get versus Google. They're also going to, in addition to this online access of the full text of books, going to provide libraries and universities the ability to purchase institutional subscriptions to the complete text of these 7 million and undoubtedly will become 10 or 15 or 20 million books. They're also going to provide terminals at public libraries and university libraries, again, in the United States, to offer other readers access to the full text of these millions of books. And finally, and of course, there are many other details that we won't be able to cover in the time allotted to us in this podcast, but they're also going to provide a kind of researcher's interface that people in higher ed can apply to do some more sophisticated analyses, the kinds of things that we've talked about in this podcast and on our blogs as well about trying new forms of digital scholarship, which is something that really interests me. But again, the details need to be seen a little bit better about how you gain access to this research corpus, as they're calling it. So given that there's still some hazy things here, I suppose the biggest thing, Tom and Mills, just to start off, is that really this agreement focused on out-of-print but in copyright books. That there's this mass of books. Indeed, they say in the agreement that it's probably about 75% of the books they've scanned are books that sort of no longer have a commercial market, but no one can get access to them unless you happen to be at a great library, for instance, like the University of Michigan Library. And so these books, many of which are really academic monographs and these sorts of things that don't have a commercial market, they go out of print, but there are still just a few copies, and so no one can access this. Isn't this a tremendous win for everybody, for the audience who wants to read those books but might not have a copy nearby, but also for the authors and publishers who might get some revenue now from people looking at the full text of that, and also to Google, which is now sort of getting out from under the shadow of this lawsuit. Is this a win-win-win?
Well, I'm personally looking forward to receiving my first check from Google someday when my book goes out of print and then people start downloading it, and then I'll get that check for 37 cents or whatever it comes to. But
you might be estimating on the high end there. Yeah,
I might be. But I'll gladly take it, and if it's under a dollar, I'll frame it. But for an institution like George Mason, which recently very proudly announced that the library had acquired its 1 millionth volume, this is really a win because George Mason is like many mass market universities around the United States and community colleges and smaller private colleges is never going to have a significant research library. It's just not going to happen. And so what this means is that all of a sudden we do. And because our students can now finally have access to literally millions of volumes that the only way that they would have access to otherwise is through interlibrary loan or journeying to one of the research libraries in our greater Washington area. And so now instead they can just sit down at their computer and have access to these books. And so that's going to make a tremendous difference. And so I'm personally very excited about that from the standpoint of teaching it, especially at the upper division with, upper level undergraduate courses, graduate courses. This is going to be really great.
Tom, what are your initial thoughts on this?
One thing I actually my biggest thought is, I'm interested that they in the settlement privileged university-based researchers and students. It's interesting that universities and patrons of research libraries are the ones who are going to have access either at terminals in the institution or online for the full text of these materials. That's not going to be as open, as available to the general public. I think it's a sign that universities and university libraries are starting to be taken as serious players in this new world of online information. I guess I'm pleased that the universities and the research libraries were at the table in these discussions, and that they were able to get certain concessions, special concessions, out of the settlement. At the same time, it maybe is a little bit problematic that this kind of increased access is going to be limited to people with a university ID card, but it is interesting that universities are starting to play a major role in these kinds of copyright and information issues.
One part of, just to clarify a little bit, one part of the agreement that I was actually very concerned about was that it would be really only university libraries, and instead, you know, they have made provision for public libraries to also have access. You have to go to the public library to do it, but at least that's a step in the right direction, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that part of it is, it reminds me of the Carnegie libraries and the sort of movement toward public libraries. I mean, if that really is carried out, and I assume that there will be all kinds of restrictions on that terminal that goes into those public libraries, like no connecting it to a printer, no USB thumb drives anywhere near it, these sorts of things. But it does provide a really almost unlimited access to a major research library that you wouldn't get if you were in a small town, you know, where your local library has 5,000 or 10,000 volumes, and where you know, as both of you are saying, that you're not connected to a university, and so you couldn't get this sort of site license for the full collection. I guess we'll have to also see how much that site license will cost as well, and how that works out.
It is kind of a funny model, right? Like, it's like in this world of the internet with instant access to information, where Google can, without any difficulty, deliver the full text of these books to anybody's computer, whether they have a university ID or not. To have to like schlep over to the library and sit down at a terminal that's not connected to, you know, sort of the wider web is kind of a weird old-fashioned model. And it's just, I think it just sort of shows still where the publishers are on this, because I'm sure that that provision was put in by the publishers.
Well, it does provide a provision now to view up to 20% of any book, at least this segment that the agreement focuses on, that is, out of print but in copyright books. You can actually, you know, from the comfort of your own home in your pajamas, view up to 20% of these books. But beyond that, I guess there'll be some kind of micropayment system, or maybe it'll be a macro payment system. Again, we'll have to see what the pricing model is on this, but you can at least, you know, access a full book from home, and then, you know, again, that revenue would be split
right
between Google and the authors. But yes, if you want the free version, you've got to, get dressed, go outside, trudge through the snow to your
well, that's,
public
but
library.
That's also, for the public, for the non-university user, that's the case. For the university user, my reading of the agreement is the same as our students' access to JSTOR from their dorms or from home, and that is that they just have to put in their student ID number through a validation process first, and then they have direct access.
Right, right.
Right. You know, it does seem that at least just looking around in the blogosphere, I mean, a lot of the heavy hitters are pretty positive on this. I mean, I think there was a great deal of worry about this case because, it was sort of the nuclear option. I mean, the possibilities were pretty, this could have been really troubling for either side of the case. I mean, Google really felt that it had a fair use case, and it was going to argue this out in court, and had it won, it would have really enforced and sort of underlined the fair use provisions. Had it lost, we would have lost in the United States at least, this ability to kind of do well. I mean, it would have really shrunken the fair use case. And I think the size of relief that I've seen in the blogosphere, and these are from heavy hitters like Larry Lessig, the lawyer who's written quite a lot about this. He seemed very positive about this settlement. Siva Vaidyanathan, who's written Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, who again worried about were Google to win or lose, there would be, you know, real sort of difficulties produced by this case. And so, in some sense, the settlement really didn't come down on either side in terms of the fair use provisions. Basically, what it did is it just stepped aside from that really thorny question of what fair use was, and it just got to, I think, a pretty pragmatic solution that provides these texts for the purposes of higher ed, learning more generally, at least in the United States, and also provided a kind of sensible revenue model that everyone could agree with. So, you know, in this way, it seems like the only losers are, well, frankly, you know, the people who stop scanning, Microsoft, for instance. Amazon also is probably troubled by this because, you know, we just talked about Android in the opening news roundup, and one can imagine it's pretty easy to put 7 million books on a bunch of Android phones right now. And so, you know, how does that compete with the Kindle? But, you know, otherwise, the authors, the publishers, the users, you know, they all got something pretty decent from this, perhaps not perfect. Am I reading that wrong? Is there something in this that we're missing that might be more seriously troubling?
I don't think so.
I don't either.
I was actually struck by the same thing that some of the, you know, and I was actually, frankly, you know, very pleased by this, that some of the kind of open access purists, some of the fair use activists weren't more bothered by this. And I think that's a good thing, because I think, you know, there's a time for standing on principle, but then there's a time for coming to a pragmatic accommodation. And I think that's what this is. And I think it will ultimately benefit everybody. So I was pleased by that.
Yeah, I don't think we've misread it. I think it really is going to be a win-win-win. I would say I've been using Google Books a lot this semester in one of my classes. And this new more or less unlimited access agreement is really going to require educators to start thinking through how they're going to teach their students how to use this resource, because I have to say that none of my students was even aware that there was something called Google Books, which was a real surprise to me. They'd never even heard of it. None of them, zero. And it came up because one of my students was looking for, she had a quotation from a book that had been published in 1825, and it had been quoted two different ways in two different venues, two other books that were published recently. And she was worried about which was the correct quotation from this 1825 book. And I said, well, why don't you just see if it's in Google Books? And she said, what's that? And so I dialed it up on the screen in class, and then we downloaded the book, that the original 1825 book, and found the correct version of the quotation and went with that. And they were all like, I just showed them some magic trick, and like, wow, you can actually download that whole book? That's incredible. And so after the next day or the next class period, several of them came in and told me how they downloaded, you know, some book that they had always wanted to own a copy of, but, you know, had never had, and that it was just so cool. And so, you know, I was really surprised that none of them had even heard of Google Books. And, you know, so we won't even get into Google Scholar. This said to me, okay, next semester, all of my classes are going to devote 30 minutes minimum to showing the students how to use this particular resource. And that was before this agreement was signed.
Yeah, I mean, unbeknownst to me, the night before this agreement came out, I actually had students in my graduate class do an exercise where we looked at scanned books on several sites, one of them being the Open Library, which is at openlibrary.org, which is indeed the sort of is run behind the scenes by the Internet Archive and includes a lot of those Open Content Alliance books. And actually, now that I go to the homepage, they've updated the number of full text books they have to 1,064,822. So indeed, they do have over a million books. And what I had them do is click, if you go to openlibrary.org and click on scanned books only and do a search for a book, you'll come up with some of these full text books that are available, and you can click on read it online. You'll go into their interface that is equivalent to the Google Books interface, where you can start flipping through the pages of the book. And I had them sort of compare and contrast that experience with the Google Books experience. And I think it's really worthwhile doing for students, because I think it really shows you the differences between the interfaces. And I think what my students came up with, they were somewhat split between the two interfaces, the number that liked each one. But the Open Library, if you haven't seen this before, has a really neat interface where it actually looks like you're flipping through the book. You see the pages turn as you sort of page through, whereas Google Books is more like a web experience where you're just scrolling down through the pages as if they're a long web page. Probably a little bit more than half the students like the additional functionality that Google Books provided. For instance, it picked out references to other books. It pulled out locations that are mentioned in the book and maps it on a Google map. When you searched for a term, it highlighted that term throughout the book. Even though the book looked more like a PDF, it actually highlighted in a yellow highlighter the terms that you were looking for. So they appreciated that extra functionality. The slight minority that appreciated Open Library more liked it for the readability, for the interface that sort of emphasizes long-form reading. And so they thought that Google Books was more like a sort of hunt-and-peck experience, and Open Library would be more for the bibliophiles out there. But it definitely, Mills, I think you're right. I mean, if we're going to have, for instance, a site license at George Mason for Google Books, we're really going to have to understand how to use it, what's there, because it's, if you go to the homepage, I mean, you have no idea what's exactly there, how to use it, and it does encourage you to use books in the same way that you use the web, of sort of just quickly looking for things and then abandoning a book and moving on, rather than long-form reading. And so I think looking at these interfaces and seeing what they'll do, I mean, this will be a critical part of the research experience for the next decade, right?
I think absolutely it will be. And so that's why, you know, we really do have to start teaching, you know, at the undergraduate level or even in high schools, depending on whether high schools have access to Google Books or not, which wasn't mentioned at all in the agreement, then, you know, we have to start teaching as quickly as possible.
And after our month off, we probably have lots of links to throw out there, things to recommend to the audience, as we do every time on the podcast. Mills, what did you find for us this time?
Well, for me this time, it's a report from the Pew Internet and American Life Project called Teens, Video Games, and Civics, Teens Gaming Experiences. And we've talked a lot about gaming on the podcast in ways that people who really aren't gamers can only do. But one of the things that really struck me about this report is just how incredibly universal video gaming has become. The Pew report says among teenagers who they define as 12 to 17 for the purposes of their research, 97% play games on a regular basis.
Wow. Is this a U.S.-only report?
Yeah, I think so.
Wow, and, still 97%.
97%. And so that's about as universal as it gets.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably more than, you know, the number that brush their teeth. That's incredible.
I think that's probably true. That is probably true. And so, but the other thing that struck me about the report is actually that game playing is a lot more social than we tend to think of it as being, that increasingly young people are playing video games with other people, either sitting in the same room with them or through these kind of massively multiplayer games online. But an awful lot of that gaming is actually done with people that they already know in the analog world. The other thing from an educational standpoint is that about a third of high school students report that they have been expected to play some kind of a video game as part of an educational exercise in their school. That also shows, I think, the degree to which it's really migrating into education. And so, I mean, I'm still a believer that this is an area where educators are going to have a really hard time, because it's, you know, I mean, we can make a video, but we can't make a movie in the same way that Hollywood can make a movie. Well, we can make an educational simulation, but we can't make a video game. Because the gaming companies are so far removed from us in terms of what they can and can't do. And so students, young people, are so cracked into the quality of the interface that I think this report really confirms for me that the only real solution is to try to figure out ways for educators and gaming companies to find some common ground to work together on really good gaming for, especially for more advanced students. Advanced meaning like high school and college.
Right. Right. Oh, well, I've got to give that report a read. Of course, we'll link to it from digitalcampus.tv. Tom, let's move on to you. What do you have for us this time?
Well, getting back to what we talked about in the news roundup, my news is I've moved to Ubuntu for my desktop operating system, and I'm recommending today is the 30th of October, and just today, just this morning, Ubuntu 8.10 was released, and it's the latest supported release of Ubuntu. It's a really very nice interface. If people want to go get it, you can go get it for free at ubuntu.com. It comes built in, all the apps come built in to it. And so it has a lot of, good replacements for, your iTunes, music management program, or your iPhoto photo management program. It has those that kind of replicate the functionality of some popular desktop apps. OpenOffice replicates the functionality of Microsoft Office. But it also has some things that most desktop operating systems don't have. It has some very interesting applications that in some ways are better than anything on the proprietary systems like Mac and Windows. One of those is an application called Tomboy, which is a note-taking program, which has some wiki-like functionalities and some it has some kind of artificial intelligence built into it where it can tell if you're typing something that actually is mentioned in another note so that it links those two notes together and does some fairly interesting things. So there's actually a lot to explore. And if you're kind of bored one weekend and have an old laptop lying around, it's actually a pretty easy install. And there's a lot of interesting things to explore. It'll get you thinking about other ways to use your machine. So I recommend it. Ubuntu 8.10.
Terrific. Yeah. I mean, this is the kind of thing where if you've got an extra computer lying around, you can burn a CD-ROM and just pop it right in and give it a try. See what you think of the interface and the application. Sorry. Well, thanks, Tom. Well, I've got an application that Tom might want to make you switch back to Mac, because it's a Mac application this week that I just got into a week ago, and that's been helping out, has made my existence better on this planet and made me more productive. It's an application called Think, and I got interested in trying to find out about this after I saw a similar application for Windows called Jedi Concentrate, which is a far better name than Think. But they both do the same things, and basically what it does is it uses the Mac OS X capability to dim out Windows, sort of provide a little drop curtain in front of Windows that's transparent to allow you to focus better on the application you're using. It's a really simple application. It's totally free. It's available at freeverse.com, so you can go and take a look at this. But basically all you do is you hit some hotkeys on your keyboard, and it just darkens out the rest of the application. So let's say if you're trying to write an article and you don't want your email to be in your face or your web browser to entice you to go check the latest news on the election, you can just turn this on, and it just dims everything out. It still allows you, of course, to just click on other applications or bring things in front of that curtain. But I think it's a really terrific application for just reducing desktop clutter and allowing you to focus a little bit more, I guess perhaps like a Jedi. That's, again, the application is just called Think from freeverse.com. Well, hopefully it will not be another month before we get together again. And looking forward to talking again, Tom and Mills, on another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.